This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
My goodness, my voice. Hi, start again. Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who enjoy writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I am so happy today. I've got two great guests. At the bottom of the hour, I'm going to be talking to Joseph Finder. He is one of my favorite authors, and he has a new book out called Judgment, and it is fascinating, and I'm looking forward to talking to him. But right now, I have in the studio with me Bill Larson of Larson & Larson, and we're going to be talking, Bill, we're going to be talking 17 U.S.C. Section 106, right?
Okay.
Well, you have to explain to everybody, what is that?
Well, it's part of the copyright laws, and one of the issues that we wanted to talk about today was licensing.
Okay? Yes, it's an important subject for authors.
It's a very important subject, and I get a lot of questions on licensing from clients all the time. What can I do, and what can I not do? And so what I like to do with my clients is first say, let's take a step back and kind of look at the way we attack our business, okay? What is our business model? And a very smart business person is going to have a business model that says, I'm going to look before I leap, okay? A lot of people just assume that they can do it. They jump into the pool and only find out that it's cold. And so we want to start from the default setting that every business person should have, which is, no, you can't do it. Okay. If you start from no, you can't do it, then that forces you to look and see if maybe I can do it. And if you're wrong and you can do it, then you don't have a problem. But if your default setting is I can do anything I want and that's not fair and I'm just going to do it, it's how people get in trouble. Okay. And so in the realm of licensing, we want to take a step back and first assume, no, I can't do it. Okay, let's explore if I can. And then we do our research to see, well, maybe that's in the public domain. If it is in the public domain, then we can do it. We don't have to pay anybody. We don't have to ask anybody. We can just go ahead and take the material, whether it's written, music, photographs, art, whatever it may be. One of our listeners here today had asked about the use of the image of Jim Morrison. Okay, very famous rock star, The Doors. Everybody loves The Doors. If you don't like The Doors, you're missing some marbles upstairs.
Exactly.
So everybody loves The Doors, and he's very intriguing. Character. And but he's deceased, right? And so the question is, well, does deceased people still have rights? Well, they do, because their rights are passed down through their inheritance, okay? And the same as Elvis, the same as with Marilyn Monroe. These are images that the descendants are going to protect, and they're entitled to do that, okay? So it's not in the public domain. Sometimes it is, but many times it is not. And in this case, Jim Morrison has an estate and a group of folks that manage his music, the 25% share he has in The Doors, and their music, right, and the lyrics he wrote and all that. But then he also has the right to his personal image, okay? And what that means is that if you're going to use that image, you got to pay. You got to pay a license. Okay, and once you pay the license, then you can use it. Now, there's two types of use. There's non-commercial use and there's commercial use. Non-commercial use may be a news article or some statement in education where you're teaching about an individual. And for those situations, you have a fair use right to use that image or that lyrics or that art or whatever it may be. But if you're writing a novel, as our listener had suggested in this case, and they wanted to use some pictures of Jim Morrison, that is going to fall into the commercial endeavor box, okay? And that means that if you're going to use images of Mr. Morrison, then you're probably going to have to pay a license fee to use them, or at least explore whether some of the images have fallen into the public domain or whether the images are still protected by copyright and you've got to pay a license. Now, in the case of Jim Morrison, his descendants make many millions of dollars a year licensing his image and his music. And so in this case, yes, you would probably want to look into what image you're going to use and who you have to pay to use the image. A good starting point for images is Getty Images, probably the biggest image warehouse licensing outfit in the world.
They bought up everything.
They got everything. They had a picture of everything.
They just went, well, they had the money, so
yes,
they can just
they
go
do.
In and they...
They're huge. They have such an inventory of images, it's unbelievable. And I've got to say that they are fair about licensing them. So, you know, go to Getty Images and get in contact with their folks there and tell them what you're doing and say, this is the image I want to use. Keeping in mind that the person that took the photograph has a copyright in the fact that they took the photograph, right? And then the person has the right, if they're famous, like Jim Morrison, in their image. So there's kind of dueling rights here. And so... because it's very difficult for small organizations and individuals or descendants of famous people to license them the images or the work themselves, they use these big licensing outfits like BMI, ASCAP, Getty Images. And that's where you want to go if you want to use images or other pieces of material that are protected by copyright in your book.
So if you use something from Getty and you pay Getty, they're responsible for paying whoever.
Right, right.
And so you don't have to worry about
it. Right, so you pay Getty and Getty doles out that percentage of the money to the estate of Jim Morrison, whoever it may be, Elvis, you know, Marilyn Monroe, all the famous people. They all have, they're all protected. And if you want to use their music, you know, then you go and you pay the Doors or the licensing agency BMI ASCAP, and then you can use the music, and then ASCAP or BMI sends their proportionate share to the Doors organization, and that's how it works. Licensing is of copyrighted works is done by big licensing outfits, these very big companies.
Now, there was a dog in here a little while ago, and this is why my throat is gone. For example, there are some photos of Jim Morrison on Wikicommons. Now, can you explain, if something is on Wikicommons, people generally assume that it's free, that they can use it.
You can if it's not for a commercial endeavor. Okay, so there's a difference between using something commercially and non-commercial.
So if you wanted to take that image and use it in a
T-shirt,
book cover.
Right, or a book cover or a candy bar or
so
something
even
like
if it's on Wikicommons, you can't use it.
Each image is different. So you have to I wouldn't take the point that everything on Wikicommons is free and you can just use it.
Well, if Wikicommons writes on the bottom in public domain.
Public domain, and that is true, then yes, then you can use it. Once it's in the public domain, it's free for everybody.
And you can trust if Wikicommons says it.
I would investigate. In every case, I would investigate. I would never, my default setting never is just to believe what somebody says. I investigate it for myself. And so you can do that by asking questions.
Because I believe I was looking at, for example, the T-shirt companies.
Mm-hmm.
And
that license.
It seems to me many of them are just taking from Wikicommons and using that image.
They may be, yeah.
In manipulating
and
it.
Some images are in the public domain, and so you can go ahead and use them commercially without paying in, and other images are not. So the question is, how do you find out whether or not they are? And what you do is you have to do an investigation in each particular instance.
So it's up to the author to discover this.
Do their research. And I'll tell you about a case I had. There's a outfit out there, freemusic.com, and they allow you to use all kinds of music that they have warehoused, but only in an editorial or non-commercial status. But a lot of people don't know that, and so they see freemusic.com, and they take it and they put it in a commercial, and then they find out later that you can't do that. You can't use it on a commercial basis. You can only use it personally. And so I tell all my clients, just because it's free doesn't mean it comes at no cost. All right, so you have to be careful and investigate in each instance whether or not you can use in that particular image, that song, that art in a commercial setting.
Because one thing that I discovered, I at one point wanted to use a song from the U.S. Air Force. And I thought, well, if it belongs to the U.S. Air Force, it belongs to us.
The government can own intellectual property.
You cannot use that. You cannot. Mm-hmm.
The government can own intellectual property just like a person or a company. No problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought, that's not fair. I see. Talking about fair, I said, I pay taxes. You know, they should just give it to me, but they wouldn't.
The U.S. government has a large bank of intellectual property.
Oh, very. I discovered that. That was funny. This is when I was working on a project several years ago, and I thought, well, this was because I was doing a promo video, and I thought, this was perfect, just what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And
if you went to them and said, here's
actually,
some money, they'd say, okay.
Yeah, exactly. Here's some money.
That's how money fixes
and
money.
And I thought, no, I think I said to the guy, I paid taxes for this. You're playing this music, and I paid for it already. But it didn't convince him. Yeah. And at the time, I didn't.
Right. The answer to the question, is this about money, is yes.
Yes.
All right. So just, you know, it's a lot safer to pay and investigate and pay the license fees. And they're not terrible. It depends on what you're doing. If you're doing something really small, sometimes you can't get a license, particularly in the NCAA. They want a certain threshold of sales before they'll let you use collegiate insignias and such.
Now, going back, because this Jim Morrison idea is one that people can relate to because they recognize him. So let's say, and everybody knows, of course, he was with the Doors. If you did a cover using a Wiki Commons guaranteed, free, you know, in the public domain photograph,
then you're okay.
You're okay. Mm-hmm. But if you put on the cover the word Doors,
then you may be straying into...
You would be in trouble, wouldn't you?
You may be in trouble because
the Doors are very, very... Whoa, they protect everything.
And they should.
They should.
They work very hard for what they made.
Oh, yeah. They really do.
And if we didn't have these intellectual property laws, then intellectual property would be stolen just left and right, and artists would have no reason to create. Inventors would have no reason to invent, because the minute they did, everybody would just steal it. And that's why we have these laws. There's a reason. It's to protect people.
Oh, China.
And, yeah.
China. Are you listening?
We have a terrible problem with the theft of intellectual property internationally, particularly overseas. And millions and billions of dollars are being taken from American companies by the theft of intellectual property.
Now, so this is it would be a very difficult sort of, you really have to be careful, even when mm-hmm. you have some, you're using part of something that is, you know, free or, you know, in public domain, but not everything, and simply even the word, I would think that the word, by putting the word Doors on it, it would cause a problem.
If you put it on the cover, it might be a problem. It might be, but if you use it in the text when you're describing, you're talking about the Doors in a factual.
Talking about him and talking about...
No one owns the facts of history.
Yeah.
Okay? They are always in the public domain. So if you use them in an expressive way that you're writing about facts and history, then anybody can do that, okay? And you can refer to those words and those names and those events and those dates and all those things. That's in the public domain. But once you stray into the area where you're kind of putting the Doors name on the cover because you're trying to attract sales, now you've kind of walked into the minefield. Yeah, the licensing
of
minefield.
Of course, this is also a good lesson for authors out there about ensuring that your intellectual property is properly done so that every I has been dotted and T has been crossed. Because Jim Morrison, when he died at the age of 27 from a drug overdose, although he left a will.
He did.
He left a will to someone,
Pam
who died herself of a drug overdose
three years later.
Yep. So it was a mess.
It was a mess. And then there ended up being a fight between the parents of Pam and the parents of Jim. And they finally worked it out in court, and they did some profit sharing, you know, license sharing. They're all deceased now.
His brother and sister still live here in Florida.
Right, yeah. So until those copyrights expire after 100 or so years, which is long after we'll be gone, the estate will continue to generate revenues from the sales of the images and the music.
And that's why all of you authors out there really, I think most authors, you know, they're writing, indie authors, they're writing their books and they're putting them on Amazon, and they don't, because they're sort of just, it doesn't seem like it might make a lot of money as an indie author, or they have them.
You never know.
Years later, somebody comes along and they like that story, mm-hmm. and they could turn it into a movie, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And if you haven't left It's partly protecting the intellectual property right, mm-hmm. making sure that they are left, because you should, in a will, you should leave your
Correct.
Intellectual property rights to somebody.
Historically, artists and authors who are now considered famous and the best of the best died broke. They weren't accepted at that time. After their death sometimes that people realized, wow, this is really great stuff. So it's a three-part process. Okay, first is the creation of the work. You're an inventor, you're an author, you've created a trademark or a brand name for something. And then the second part is what we call perfection. Perfection in the law means that you went to the government, you filled out the form, you gave the government their money, and they gave a piece of paper back to you, which perfects your interest. And when I say perfection, that means you have a legal remedy. In other words, you can go to the court and ask the judge for help. Okay, so the perfection, or the filing of the copyright application, the patent application, and achieving registration is what I call the key to the courtroom door. If you don't perfect your rights and you don't get them registered, then they will enter the public domain and there's absolutely nothing you can do. The third part is estate planning, because we're all going to die, and when we do, and if you have some money, or money may come afterwards, even if it's not there now, that your descendants can reap the benefits of your work. And so it's a three-part process: the creation, the perfection by filing an application and registering it and paying maintenance fees and renewal fees to keep them active, and third is estate planning, so that when you pass on, your descendants or your trust or whatever you want to set up, you'll give it to your church, whoever it may be, will reap the benefits of your work.
And you should specifically mention in your will
Absolutely.
Your intellectual property.
Well, you list all of it.
And
yeah.
list all of it.
The best way to do it is in a trust rather than a will.
Because when we say property is a value.
Intellectual property will have the most value. You know,
you never know.
Your tangible assets will dissipate, or you know, but your intellectual property could go on for years and years and years and years. In the case of copyrights, it could be 100 years. That's a lot of money.
It is. So it's something really authors have to think about. And I, because when I was reading about the mess with Jim Morrison's, family and what they had to
There's been hundreds of bitter fights over the years over the estates and the money coming in for licensing post death of a famous person. And a lot of times they die untimely. Jim Morrison is, part of what they call the 27 Club, which is a very horrible thing.
And Janis Joplin, who I knew.
And Ron McKernan and scores of others who all died at around the same age. It's kind of weird.
Yeah.
But in any event, Jim Morrison did, in fact, do some estate planning. So his descendants are reaping the benefits of his, work. And he's one of the most brilliant poets. And
oh, absolutely.
Has one of the best rock voices that will ever be. And so I think it's right that his descendants should reap those benefits.
Exactly. And the thing is that the book that I referred you to was the author discovered and did all the research that he had a very big connection here in Clearwater.
He did. He actually went to St. Pete Junior College, which was just a mile from our studio here for a brief time, a year or so, until he moved on to Tallahassee. Very interesting that such a famous person would be right here in little old Clearwater Beach.
Yeah, and so much of his inspiration for his music came from although he was not... At that point, playing, he was not, involved in music other than
back in the 60s, this was a one-horse town.
Yeah.
I mean, we're really crowded now.
Yeah.
But back in those days, we were kind of off the grid.
But that it served as an inspiration for him,
mm-hmm.
I think
I'm
it's
sure.
remarkable. And
I'm sure.
And I think it's a delightful book, and I'm want
it's
to
a
help.
Great subject. He's intriguing. He's... I mean, not only is he good looking, he has a great voice, he's a great poet. I mean, he's got everything that a tragic character has, right?
It's such a shame, of course. And as I mentioned to you earlier, when I was in Paris, I visited his grave. Like so many of our generation, I think we all, it's...
I can remember when I was very young. I'm an old hippie now turned old trial lawyer, just... cranking the doors, and my mother, turn it down.
Yeah.
Don't you boys know any good music? This is awful. Because there's a great deal of backlash against the Doors in the 60s because they were really pushing the envelope.
Well, especially if mothers actually listened to the words.
Turn it down.
Yes. In a way, it was good that it was so loud they couldn't actually make out the words.
Right.
So that worked out. But anyway... Wow, I really appreciate all this knowledge that you're giving to my listeners, because they do go through these sort of terror fits there. Like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. But and I think some of them are missing out on the opportunity to you know, benefit from their own work because they're hesitant about intellectual property. So just knowing more about it really is helpful.
Right. So if you're writing a book about Mozart, you can use his picture, right? His drawing, right? Because that stuff, you know, expired. There's no copyright in any of that anymore.
Well, yeah, you know, but if you try to use the images that are online,
they could be copyrighted in themselves as if they're drawings and such.
If you try to use from a museum, they get you. Right. I mean, if you try to take the image from, like, what did I try to do once? And I've always tried. I didn't mean to do it, but, you know, I was like, I wanted to use this image, and they said
it's often innocent.
They said we own the picture.
That's
it's
right.
In our like the National Gallery. They own all those pictures, so they.
They own the copyrights, the right to reproduce.
So the only way you can use them is if you find them in an old book, which I did.
Okay, and they were in the public domain.
Yes, they were in the public domain. Well, I found a beautiful colored, one of those early photographs where they colored it, actually colored it.
Yes,
and black and white was days. You know, from the 1830s. Mm-hmm. So nope, that was free. Nope. I could use it.
Right. So everything eventually goes to the public domain. Nothing's forever. Trademarks can last forever as long as you continue to sell the product, but patents and copyrights both expire after a certain time.
Okay, and so that was sort of is that part of that Mickey Mouse the 70 years was
the
Protection Act.
So what happened was Mickey Mouse was coming close to expiration back in 2000, and so they lobbied very heavily and had the laws changed so that the time for protection was extended, which has happened many times over the course of our country's laws since we first had copyrights all the way back to the Constitution. So it's not unusual that they keep extending them. I think we're probably coming to the end of where we're going to extend them anymore. But yeah, that was part of the act back around about 2000. And now, of course, here we are 18 years later. So Mickey Mouse, again, in certain respects, is going to enter the public domain, some of it.
Yeah. Ooh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Well. Whoa, it's sort of like, what's the movie? A Christmas movie? Ooh. What's a Jimmy Stewart movie? My mind went. It entered the public domain, and now it's on every channel at Christmas, and they don't have to pay anything for it.
No, once it's in the public domain, it's free for use.
And they can just use it, and it's sort of like...
We just... believe as a country, and so we made laws that said that they're entitled to the exclusive use for a limited amount of time, and that kind of goes back to the whole anti-monopoly theory that we have in our country, that, you know, we don't like monopolies and we don't want things to last forever. We want things to go into public.
But we want to be fair.
But we want to be fair for a certain amount of time.
That it's fair for an author. Like, I mean, when he died at 27, if he had actually had children, you know, if he had like 5 children. You'd want his children to be able to reap the benefits, and so it's
crazy. In Jim Morrison's case, he died very wealthy, and for the time, and he had estate planning, but Pam didn't, and so she died intestate without children, and that's what
that caused
created
the ruckus.
Okay,
well, Bill, how can people get in contact with you?
LarsonPatentLaw.com,
and they can. You're happy to talk to anybody about all of this. Give Bill
through.
A call, and you just go to the
There's web. Also great information online where you can go to the patent office or the copyright office or the trademark office online. Wonderful free information that your government has created for you. Go there and read the government sites. They're very well done.
And I understand you have a convention coming up right here in Florida.
Right here in Tampa.
Intellectual property people all...
All over the world.
All
every
the
country
world.
Of the world. Yep, coming right here to Tampa.
Okay, so probably if you're walking downtown and they're all going to be...
See a lot of suit and ties next week, then you'll know why.
Yeah, suits and ties, guys. You did tap on the show. So.
And ladies, too. You
and
know,
lady. Oh,
you know,
yes.
When I first joined way back when, it was probably 99% men, and now it's probably more women than men. So just in my lifetime, it has gone... a lot of women have entered the intellectual property field, the legal field, which I think is wonderful.
It is. Well, law schools are filled with women,
almost more than 50%.
Which leads me into my next guest. And this book is called Judgment.
Excellent.
And by Joseph Finder. And it is about a lady judge. Mm-hmm. And so, and again, it's a very exciting book, and it's about a strong and powerful woman. So
we have lady judges here on our federal bench here in Tampa who are wonderful. I think they're the smartest people I've ever met or talked to or had the pleasure to litigate in front of in their courts. And so, yes, I think it's a good thing that we have women.
Absolutely.
And diversity.
And diversity.
In our legal system, because that's what makes it fair.
Okay. Well, you have fun at the convention.
I will.
And you'll come back and tell us some of the stuff that you learn and,
ideas.
If you learned something new. And help all of our listeners who are writing a book or thinking about writing a book to protect
themselves. Look, before you leap, okay, just check it out. Don't assume that you can do it. Take a step back. Do your research online.
Okay. Well, that's great. So remember, it's Bill Larson at Larson & Larson, and just go to the net and larsonpatentlaw.com. Okay. Thanks so much for being here today. And we're going to play a quick book buzz, and then we'll be back after the commercials. Okay.
This is Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest book buzz mystery. Uneasy Lies the Crown. A Lady Emily mystery by New York Times best-selling author of smart historical fiction, Tasha Alexander. Here's the buzz. In Uneasy Lies the Crown, Lady Emily and her husband Colin must stop a serial killer whose sights may be set on the new king, Edward VII. The year is 1901, and the death of Britain's longest reigning monarch has sent the entire British Empire into mourning. As this long, delightful series featuring Lady Emily Hargreaves continues with lush detail, beautiful surroundings, sparkling personalities, and the great mystery readers have come to expect. The Victorian details are engaging. Secondary characters are wildly entertaining. So grab a cup of tea and a scone and sit in your favorite easy chair and enjoy Uneasy Lies the Crown by New York Times best-selling author Tasha Alexander.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z, and I am back, and I'm just waiting for a call in from really a writer who is so good at his work that he's, you know, you pick up his book and you start reading it, and it is really a book that you can't stop reading. And his new book is called Judgment, and I'm so happy that he's going to be on the program today. Meanwhile, I don't know if he's up in New York, Joseph Finder, but I wanted just to remind everyone again that the Writer's Digest competition, contest, whatever you want to call it, is the deadline is May 9th. So if you have a book that has not been published, and or a poem or even a script, go to Writer's Digest and look at the requirements and the application and submit something. If you have something that you feel is ready to be shown to really the top people in New York City, because the wonderful thing about the Writer's Digest contest, as I've mentioned to you, is that it is the readers are either literary agents, top editors at the major publishing companies. These are not just nobodies. They are people who know good writing. They recognize it quickly. And not only you might win one of, there's going to be, I think, over 1,000 prizes this year, you might win, but sometimes even, Gail Honeyman was submitted a book that wasn't even finished, and she won, didn't win the prize, but she so intrigued an agent, a London agent, who read the book. The London agent, after the contest, contacted her and said, well, you know, I think this book has such potential. And, of course, she had to work on it a little bit and get it in shape. But eventually she got, I think she got a seven-figure deal. So you never know. And that's why it's so important that if you're going to take this seriously, that you make the effort to enter some of these really good contests. The San Francisco Writers Contest, it's this year is too late, but you still have time for the Writers Digest Contest. And go to their site and have a look and see, you know, it's just an opportunity. And I hope that if you do, you let me know your progress, and if you get a wonderful review, even. It's just so great. So I'm just waiting now a few minutes, and it's going to be fun because, you know, sometimes you get a book that it's just timely and just perfect, and this certainly is. And so I'm going to be talking to him in a little while. Also, I wanted to mention, I've been going through Facebook. Please like my Facebook page. It's Radio Joy on Paper. If you would go there and like my page. I sort of was off of it for a month there because everything was so hectic here at the beginning of the year, as I'm really trying to organize my calendar and get everything all organized for the year. But I am back and very active on it again, and I want to make sure that if you have a minute, follow me there, and I will be posting all of the exciting, both the guests that I'm going to have, and also I'm going to have a couple of seminars. One of them I mentioned the other day, it's about Scrivener. Now, if you are writing a book, particularly a memoir, a nonfiction book, or a book that has a lot of characters, for example, a sci-fi book where you have a lot of different characters and you have to keep track of them, and they might have different looks, they might have different clothes, they might have different whatever, I would highly recommend that you use Scrivener. And so I'm trying to find a place, maybe a library, where I will be able to hold a little seminar to explain how much easier your work will be is if you use Scrivener. Scrivener is it's a word processing program. It costs very little, I think about $29, but it can save you, I am absolutely sure it can save you hundreds of hours of frustration and nervous energy, simply because everything is so well organized. You can keep all of your research notes, all of your references, everything right there in one program. You can move chapters up and down. You can make sub-chapters. And all of that will be so easy with Scrivener. So if you want to ask me some questions about it, go to my webpage and send me a question, and I will be happy to talk to you about it. And then, you know, well, what else? I have just waiting now here for a few minutes because it's always so exciting when I get an author on whose books I know so well. As a matter of fact, it's so funny that some authors, their words or their story stay with you long, long after you've read the books. And in this case, when I am talking to one of my favorite authors, Joseph Finder, I can tell you, hi, Joe.
Hey, how are you?
Okay. Well, you know, it's so funny. When I have an author who really makes an impact on me, I will be thinking about him years later, or when I go to certain places, something will come to mind, and I'll say, oh, I know where I read about that. Last time you were on, I mentioned to you that probably I'm one of the few people who has interviewed you who actually read Red Carpet. Your first book. And the funny thing is, I remember where I read it. I was at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, D.C.
Oh, wow.
And it was a timely book at the time. And fascinating for somebody like me who's interested in such subjects. And then I'm reading that, and then when I started this radio show many years later and I get to talk to you, I think that is so funny because because I was sort of doing research in the same general area, that was so wonderful that after years later I get to talk to you. And I have that book, which is now, it sells for $75.
What's that?
The hardback book sells for $75 now.
Oh, that's crazy. I know that they've really inflated the prices.
Well, it's a collector's item now because that was all the way back in 83. And
Out of print, long out of print.
But the funny thing is how much of what you wrote about, and at the time people scoffed, and there were a lot of scoffers out there, how much has proven to be correct?
Yeah, that's right.
It's almost spooky.
It is. It's really interesting.
Oh, spooky when I'm talking to a spook. Oh, my goodness. Oh, I'm good today. Because we have to explain to my listeners who don't know, but many of them do because I talk about you quite often, that you were a spook, a CIA guy. And I always love to talk to people who know what they're writing about. And you certainly do.
I was recruited to the CIA. And I realized that I would have to probably sit in a cubicle translating Soviet economic journals from Russian to English. So I never was officially affiliated with CIA.
Well, sort of not.
Anyway.
Okay. But
moving on.
Yes, we will move on from that. But I will tell you, somebody with your knowledge of Russian and being able to get into the minds of the characters that you talked about in Red Carpet, now translate into this fascinating book called Judgment. And in there we have a Russian word that might have some relevancy.
That's right. You know, that word is kompromat.
Aha.
Kompromat. Kompromat is a Russian word that is short for compromising material. And that is damaging information about a politician or a businessman or a public figure that's used for blackmail or extortion. And kompromat, kompromat, it's been around for a long time. The Russian intelligence service is really good at compiling files on people and blackmailing them. And we're seeing more and more of this today. We're hearing of the word has become familiar to a lot of people now, right? And I just sort of thought, what if that world touched the everyday world of a judge in Boston? Could that happen? And my feeling is, yes, it absolutely sure could happen.
And that's where you came out with this really brilliant book. And It's so funny. You know, they always talk about torn out of the headlines, but in this case, in this case, boy, you ripped that whole newspaper apart. You got it all, I can tell you. You got a strong, wonderful, strong character. You have to tell us about her, because I think you based her off of some of the judges I think that you've spoken to. She is amazing.
Isn't she tough? I like her. She's a kick-ass character. I really loved writing her. I mean, the thing about judges is they tend to be passive. There's a reason you don't see novels about judges very often, is that judges basically, things happen to them. They're reactive. I wanted to have a judge who was a protagonist, who was proactive, and...
And so Juliana Brody is definitely, turns out to be proactive.
Right? Yeah. And, you know, she finds herself entrapped in a blackmail situation. And she realizes if she goes along with it, her life is over. She's going to have to fight it. So she basically, she finds herself becoming as ruthless as the bad guys who are entrapping her. And that's the only way to get out of it.
And boy, oh boy, does she do it!
Yeah,
it's one of these books that it moves. You have some great action in there. It's fantastic.
Oh, thank you so much. I sort of my feeling is that my job is to make the reader turn the pages as fast as possible. So I make the reader not want to put the book down until it's done. So that's what I work on most of all, is making hooks between chapters and making sure that we really were rooting for the main character.
Well, that's important. You know, I love your Nick Heller books.
Thank you. The
last time we spoke, it was about Guilty Minds. And
yep.
It's so funny, you know, one of your first one, Vanished. Now, this shows what a great writer you are, because I still... Even years later, after reading Vanished, when I go or people are eating sushi, I still remember the opening to that where you talk about he's the Stalin of sashimi and what the Mussolini of maki. And so when I'm with people who are eating sushi, because I don't eat sushi, much like the character in the book. And I say to people, oh, don't be the Mussolini of maki. Don't be the star. So you see, that's great writing, when people are still remembering your writing years after you wrote a book.
I love that. Yeah, I remember thinking of those terms as I was writing about the character in Spanish.
Well, I thought
it's so great that you remember that.
I thought, well, you know, because of course you speak Russian and you did Russian, you studied Russia, and you obviously from Red Carpet, you understand a little bit of the mentality.
Yep.
So I thought, wow, that was so good. And so when I tell people that now, they'd love that, because they say, oh, who wrote that? I said, well, you know, it's justified, you have to read Vanished, because that, by the way, is one of the best openings. That opening, I think, I'm not sure if it's called the prologue or the vanishing, where that is so good. We're talking about exciting, where you can't turn the page. You can't stop reading every word of that prologue. That is so good.
Fantastic. Yeah. I love hearing that. Thank you so much.
Well,
I remember writing that scene. It's a very intense opening. Yeah, it really is.
It is. It's very intense. The new book... It's very intense. After a few pages, we're sort of sucked into it, and we say, oh, first of all, we realize we really like Juliana Brody. We like her. She's a judge. There's something just, you create a very nice person. We're really interested in her. We really want, you know, everything. We sort of hope it won't turn out bad, and then boom.
You root for her.
Yeah, and boy, then it goes into action.
Yeah, her life just turns upside down, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. Well, I think that, when we talk about compromat, it's so funny. I was talking to another author, and I said, you know, anybody who's been to Moscow, anybody who's been there knows knows when you know when in the old days when you'd walk in a room. You know, of course, I don't know if they still have those little ladies at the end of the corridor, but when you'd walk in a room, the first thing you do is say hi to the light bulb hanging from the ceiling, and
yep.
and you would start singing something like "The Yellow Rose of Texas." I always thought that was a great song to sing very loudly,
just to annoy them.
Yeah, yeah.
Annoy the people who are listening.
Yeah, because I think I always thought that one was like what?
No, I mean that's. You knew back then when you visited the Soviet Union, you knew that the rooms were bugs. There was bugs in the lamps and the light fixtures.
Everywhere you went. And then when you took a shower, if you wanted to, because the water was never hot, if you wanted to, girls were not, I can say sometimes one decided to wear one slip in the shower.
Yep. Because you don't know if you have any privacy there.
Well, you don't. And
and they're recording and they're taking pictures
so that's why I think the book is very relatable. Now we understand that but I think anybody who, it's so funny that they could get anybody because we all knew what they were doing. You know, it's sort of now.
Yeah.
Crazy. It's so crazy, but you have. You know, and of course, in here we have the talk about the Ukraine and all of this stuff that I wish people would know. I think people should go back and read The Red Carpet and get a better understanding, because people really don't understand how terrible it is. You know?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I mean, this is, you know, I started out as a Russia expert. That was my first book, was a nonfiction book about Russia, and I find myself circling back. I mean, I could not resist it while I was writing Judgment. There's all these, every day there was a story about the Russians and meddling in the election, and that really began to leak into my consciousness.
And the nice thing from my point of view and for readers is that you know what you're talking about, because you have this really solid background. So many people are now, they're writing all sorts. I get so many books. Every other one has something. They throw in something. But I know that they don't know what they're talking about, because most of them have never even been to Europe and they're writing these books. And so, and certainly they haven't been to any of the countries that one one learns to think in a different way when one lives in some of these other countries. So that's why I really appreciate your writing. I appreciate you know what you're talking about. Sort of, it's like I just recently spoke to Andrew Grant, another author who knows that kind of world, and so. It's wonderful what you've done in this book.
Andrew's a great guy. I like him a lot. He's a good writer too.
Oh, he is. He's a great writer, and he knows the mindset of the people that he's writing about, and that's exactly what you do.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of think there's a reason for doing research, because you want to get the details right, and you want to get the details right that everyone knows. So that people don't say, "Oh, that would never happen," but you also want to get the details right that people don't know. I basically want them to trust me, to know that, you know, that if I'm telling them a fact about Putin, it's real. It really happened.
And that's authenticity. In the end, that's the difference between a great book and just a average, you know, run of the mill book. It's that authenticity of the author for his subject and for making sure that his characters live up to that knowledge and research.
And it's great. And I mean, I love doing the research. I love finding things out and then telling my readers. That's one of the cool things about my job, is basically learning things, because I think we all want to learn something, and passing it on to my reader.
Well, you certainly do, but people have to read fast in this book because you can't stop. and the important thing now, I have to ask you: are you working on another Nick Heller book.
And yep.
I have something to look forward to. I love it.
Yeah. I'm writing a Nick Heller number 4.
Okay. Well, remember we were talking last time about who should play Nick Heller. When you've written enough books, you have to write enough books so that you have control of the whole thing, and and you can dictate who is going to play it. You are not, of course. We already discussed Clooney's too old, and Matt Damon's not handsome enough. Because I love Nick Heller. I just think he's so great. He is not a private eye. He is a private spy, and
exactly.
And he's so good. And of course, you are such a wordsmith. I think we talked about that before. That there are writers, and then there are wordsmiths, and that's what you are. So you. I'm so thrilled that, you know, it's always so much fun. I always get the book before everybody else.
Yeah.
So when I get the next Nick Heller book, I am going to just take a day. I'm going to just take my whole day, and I'm going to really enjoy it. Okay.
I'm loving writing it, I have to say. I love writing the Nick Heller book.
Well, you can tell.
But Judgment is also, you know, she is a character who I really loved writing. She's sort of akin to Nick Heller.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking. I was thinking the same thing, and I really think you've done a great job with Julianne Brody. People will remember that name too, because it's just so well done. And Judgment is available wherever books are sold. It's a wonderful book. People will enjoy it. And Joe, what's your website? It's Josephine?
I have a brand new website I'm very excited
about.
It's a Joseph Finder, FINDER, josephfinder.com.
Okay. And so that's going to be, you'll have all the information there. And I think it's just so wonderful that we're going to look forward to a series in a few years, once you have a few more books of Nick Heller streaming video, and everybody's going to be really happy. So thank you so much. I really,
thank
really
you
appreciate
for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Great talking to you.
Okay. All right. That's really nice. I'm so happy that he was on today, because, again, another... A series that we can look forward to someday, I hope, on one of those streaming videos, because really right now they don't have anything. I'm going crazy trying to find something worth watching. One of the other things I want to say is that special thanks to Glenn Erickson for his support of Joy on Paper. I really appreciate it. I know that he's working now to get his books. He's going to, I think, re-release some of the books, and so I'm looking forward to having him back on the program, because he really epitomizes what I talk about, this finding the joy on paper and just having a wonderful time with it, and just, you know, you have to always think one of the joys of life really is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're really lucky, to have them someday say these words, lights, camera, action, and you will have your book turned into a television series, streaming video, something like that. And Carol J. Perry will someday be on Hallmark Channel. She's going to be here in the studio with me on February 26th, and we're going to be talking about her new book, Final Exam. Wow, my sister Natalie loves it. She just read it. It's called Final Exam, and Natalie is a connoisseur of cozy mysteries, and she's going to give her stamp of approval for this wonderful book. So I'm looking forward to having Carol here in February. Meanwhile, say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed, and bye-bye, and he's saluting me, I'm saluting him, and everybody have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. Bye.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City Tampa Bay WZHR Zephyr Hills
FM 104.3
Listen.
It's time for the Thursday edition of Canada Calling, the news from home for vacationing Canadians. Prior Smith speaking from Toronto. Thanks for joining us. There's a new wrinkle in the diplomatic feud between Canada and China